Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When you watch commercial television these days, the negative campaign ad is almost always with you. The familiar shades of gray, the resonant and threatening voiceovers, all of which is punctuated by musical chords custom tuned for fear, or so it seems. Probably the most talked about race in terms of its negative campaign ads in Ohio right now is the U.S. Senate contest between incumbent Sherrod Brown and Republican challenger and first-term Ohio State Treasurer Josh Mandel. Just in case you're unsure what we're talking about, here's a Mandel ad about Brown.
What is 37-year politician Sherrod Brown hiding with his negative ads? Brown bailed out Wall Street, gave huge bonuses to executives, sent billions of our tax dollars to foreign countries, and cast the deciding vote on the government takeover of healthcare. Time for a change? Marine veteran Josh Mandel earned the highest possible credit ratings as state treasurer. He cut the budget and protected tax dollars. Josh Mandel.
I'm Josh Mandel, and I approve this message.
And here's a Brown ad about Mandel.
I'm Sherrod Brown, and I approve this message.
January 26th, State Treasurer Josh Mandel misses his 13th straight meeting of the investment board he chairs. He's in D.C. raising money for his Senate campaign, one of 32 trips to places like San Francisco, the Bahamas, Hawaii, all while failing to show up for work.
The total absence of Josh Mandel makes him unique among modern era treasurers.
Josh Mandel, a politician we can't trust.
So how do these ads help a campaign, and why, despite our protestations about their negativity, do ads such as these endure? I know the answer to that. It's because they tend to work. Joining us now to talk about all of that is Republican political consultant Mark Weaver. He's founder of Communications Council, fixture in the Ohio political scene. Mark's written hundreds of campaign plans and within those produced more than 1,500 TV and radio commercials, award-winning many of them. Welcome to the show, Mark Weaver.
Good morning, Ann.
And also with us, Hank Scheinkopf. He's president of Scheinkopf Limited. It's a full-service strategic communications company that has worked on an estimated 700 political campaigns on four continents in 14 foreign nations and 44 American states in the last 35 years. His clients have included President Clinton and New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Welcome to the show, Hank.
Thank you for having me on.
For our listeners, coming up later, we want to talk about whether you think negative ads are just plain unhealthy for us. Give us your thoughts. 614-292-8513. So, Hank Scheinkopf and Mark Weaver, first, let's talk about what we mean by a negative campaign ad. At least, what do you mean by a negative campaign ad in the business? Hank?
I think an ad that draws distinctions between two people in a campaign that has an incontrovertible argument that is so good that if the opponent tries to get to defend it, his hand or her hand sticks there and they can't get caught. It's kind of can't get it off. It's kind of like the hot pot. Once you touch it, it's broiling, and you leave some skin behind. You got to hit bone and keep running.
And if you try to fight it, you're just making it better.
We're making it easier for the other side to undo you.
Mark Weaver, agreed?
In some way. I mean, that's certainly one brand of a negative ad, but a negative ad is just following the natural course of human nature, which is when we find out something bad about a choice, we're less likely to make that choice, whether it's a politician or whether it's a restaurant that we attend. If you find out that the restaurant on the west corner of the street has had a health report that said that there's been unclean practices in the kitchen, you're less likely to patronize it. And so negative information has a way of motivating people.
I'm not sure that that's entirely accurate. This is kind of like pornography, and people all say, well, it's awful, but they love to see it. It's really, we become a culture of gossip and entertainment, and that's what moves people. And that they're moved by this. It's entertaining. The rest of what we see on the screen is pretty lousy. And of the two ads you played on the way in, without viewing the pictures, the first one was better than the second one because the first one was much more poignant, to the point, and much more dramatic without even looking at the visuals. People want to be entertained because we live in a culture of gossip and entertainment, and negative ads are frankly entertaining.
Mark Weaver, I mean, you've got to pull people in somehow. You got to grab them.
Well, that's true of any ad, whether it's positive or negative. Mm-hmm. I don't think Hank and I are disagreeing here that if people have negative information, they're going to act on it. And if it's presented in an interesting and memorable way, it will be remembered.
Is it even useful to talk about positive campaign ads these days? Do they play enough of a role to even warrant discussion? Hank?
Yeah. Look, When I was a young person in this business, or younger, how's that? Mm-hmm. People used to say, well, what you need to do is remember there's three stages to a campaign. You got to run a positive ad, then you run a comparative ad, and then you go to negative, and then you close it up. Nonsense. The presumption there is that people, the great population out there, is sitting and waiting, will not do anything until they hear what we have to tell them, which is they're not going to go to the toilet, they're not going to eat, they're not going to pay their bills, but they're just patiently waiting. It's nonsense, because they're not, and especially in the environment that has the numbers of stations and outlets, and the average American gets 20,000 advertising hits a day. You need to be able to get to them quickly, and what you're going to see, and you're seeing more of, is instant comparatives, i.e., so-and-so did this, so-and-so did this, so-and-so did this, now so-and-so did this, so-and-so did this, and then you close it out, because you're not, there's no time, and people are just not paying attention, which is why you see the plethora of negative spots to get to people quicker, because they're not watching.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Weaver, how much of your business is positive type of ads?
Less and less anymore, although that has a lot to do with the availability of airtime and the availability of money. It is true that a negative message is more memorable. If you find out that a particular politician has done something that offends you politically or otherwise, you're just much less likely to vote for that person, and you very, very well might choose their opponent as an option. In a field race, though, and there's some places where there are field races still where several people are running at the same time, and the ones who get the highest number of votes are the ones who win, we tend to see more positive races there because you just can't knock out one person and win. And in judicial races, we see a lot more positive commercials because people don't pay much attention to who the candidates are, and repeating the name over and over sometimes has an effect that boomerangs on you.
My guests are Hank Scheinkopf, president of Scheinkopf Communications, and also Mark Weaver, founder of Communications Council, both schooled and adept in the art of the political ad. In this case, we're talking about the negative political ad. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I was wondering, Hank, after 35 odd years in the business, as you follow the races, just casually, if that's possible, do you automatically sort of tally up when a stump speech or an interview comment by a political candidate will become fodder for a negative ad? You kind of slap your knee and go, oh, there's another one.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I listen to the things they do, and I watch their facial gestures when I see them, when I'm traveling all over the country, mm-hmm. wherever I am. And I say to myself, well, that person's about to get whacked, you know, and that's kind of interesting. What's fascinating to me is that politicians still don't understand after all these years. Now we're now in the first political ads, modern political campaign was 1948. And it wasn't the Truman Dewey thing. It was the campaign to kill socialized medicine, which ultimately became Medicare later in history. But that they haven't learned anything from that period of time forward. That they're just not they're not immortal. And you still have this great sense of immortality among some pals that'll just say whatever they want and don't understand why they're going to get whacked from it and how things can be distorted or taken out of context either.
Mark.
Yeah, I mean, it's this is, you know, we talk about the modern age of television. Of course, before television, there were negative ads in other forms.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I go back to my earlier point. It's human nature. When you find out a bad thing about an option, you're less likely to make that option.
People are just gossips, and they like gossip, you know, and it's beautiful gossip.
Well,
you know?
They also like scary movies. Is that why we're getting scarier and scarier music? Or maybe it's not that scary. But the so-called ads that distort, that use sound effects and change the tint of the graphics and that sort of a thing. Mark Weaver, I mean, how do you decide how dark to tint it or how scary to make the music?
I've done that. I do less of that lately. There's a trend in media consulting where just presenting your opponent saying something dumb without changing the sound or the color at all of the tint can be as effective as the old scary style, particularly when they've said something really stupid.
They just let them keep saying it over and over again?
Well, we put it in the context, you know, show the voter what they said in case the voter didn't see that clip. Sometimes that's enough. Sometimes you need to cut to voters who are reacting to that and telling the impact of that particular statement on that voter's life.
See, Hank Scheinkopf, does a negative ad ever backfire?
Oh, sure.
Can you give us a good example?
Good example. Not off the top of my head. Okay. I mean, because I don't really want to go after any particular producer.
Sure, of course. But the type of ad...
They can backfire if the facts are not sustainable and people are not stupid. I mean, look, this electorate has more information than any other electorate in history. They're online. They're getting all kinds of information from all kinds of different sources. So they're not stupid, and they know a lot of things, and they're not easily fooled. You have to have tremendous regard for the intelligence of the American voter, and that may be one of the reasons why they're not turning out with great numbers and intensity. Is they're really down. People who think 2008 was a record election are just deluding themselves. The record election, I think, was 52 or 54 in that ballpark when you had major 52. You had major, major turnout. We haven't had anything like that since.
Mark Weaver, I remember back in the day when Lee Fisher was running against Betty Montgomery for Secretary of State. I'm sorry, for Attorney General, and issue was made about her work as a prosecutor in Wood County. It was a very negative ad, and he was just lacerated for it, and his campaign was lacerated for it. However, one of the people in the campaign made the point to me, yes, but it did move the voters. It was moving the numbers for him in the right direction.
Well, it moved the numbers, and that was the David Axelrod ad for your trivia fans.
Okay.
David Axelrod was Fisher's consultant that year. It moved the numbers until we did our reply ad that pointed out that Lee Fisher had never been a prosecutor. And immediately he lost his credibility as somebody who could criticize a county prosecutor. And by doing that and refocusing it on that point, the numbers had been moving against us, immediately started moving back our way. And, of course, Betty Montgomery beat Lee Fisher that year.
Which makes the point of the original thing I said. The argument has got to be incontrovertible, and you got to be sure that you're not subject to attack. You know, you've got to be able to go forward and not worry about whether the attack backfires.
How effective is the Who's More American ads? The questions, when questions are raised about someone's patriotism and that sort of a thing, is that getting old, or does that still have some tread on that tire?
It's effective with people who care about who's more patriotic, just like ads about who's more pro-Israel or who are more pro-defense or more pro-choice or more pro-anything, depending on who you're targeting. If that base of voters still cares about that issue, those ads will be effective.
It's always context.
Mm-hmm.
Something I learned, something Mark Penn, the pollster, taught me a long time ago, I guess in the presidential campaign in 96. It was always context. You can't talk to people. You can't speak a different. You can't speak some. Let's see. You can't speak a Chinese to people who live in a place where there are no Chinese. You can't speak a Spanish to people where there are no people who speak Spanish. You have to talk in the language and the argot, the very idiom that of the people you're trying to convince, or you're trying to calm down, or you're trying to get to do something. And this is a very difficult process. And people like Mr. Weaver and others deserve tremendous credit. Why? The ability to get 51% of a population to do anything at any given time is an extraordinary achievement. To get them to do it all at the same day is pretty amazing, okay? And you have to be able to talk to them in a way that gets them to want to do that. That's the real hard-edge problem in this business, getting tougher to do all the time.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. I want to thank you for joining us, Hank Scheinkopf. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me in.
Hank Scheinkopf, he's president of Scheinkopf Communications, and also Mark Weaver. Mark, thanks for joining us again. We appreciate it.
And it was good to talk to you.
Mark Weaver, founder of Communications Council. Coming up, we're going to talk with PolitiFact. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And Wednesday night on WOSU-TV, learn about a river that flows out of the highlands of Angola and into the Kalahari Desert, where most of its waters simply evaporate in the wetlands. Yet the river, the delta, and its floodplains support one of the most unusual ecosystems in the world, transforming a hostile environment into a Garden of Eden. Watch as predator and prey engage in a struggle for survival. It's Nature, Kalahari, the Flooded Desert, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. And support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, which announces the exhibition B.B. Miller, Tracing History, on view at the Urban Arts Space,
August 23rd through September 29th. Opening reception is August 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. More information is available at uas.osu.edu. And 68 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today with a good chance of rain, a high of 81. Cloudy skies for tonight, a low of 54. Sunshine for Wednesday, a high of 82. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Again, we're talking about the negative political ad today. There's the art and then there's the substance and the question of whether the issue raised in the ad is fair and whether the facts put forth in the ad are accurate and or in context. Such measures have gained popularity in recent years, but who has the time to vet the tidal wave of ads these days? Ad watches are familiar newspaper sidebars, with the Tampa Bay Times and its media partners taking the lead in helping us find the truth in politics with PolitiFact. Joining us now to talk about that is Robert Higgs. He's the deputy metro editor for The Plain Dealer and the editor of PolitiFact Ohio since its creation in July 2010. It is a partnership between The Plain Dealer and PolitiFact.com that to date has rated more than 400 claims related to Ohio politics. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Morning. Glad to be here.
Let's start with two examples on the same topic, Medicare. Let's first listen to, we'll listen to them back to back. The Obama ad is first, followed by an ad from the Romney campaign.
Now Mitt Romney's attacking the president on Medicare? The nonpartisan AARP says Obamacare cracks down on Medicare fraud, waste, and abuse, and strengthens guaranteed benefits. And the Ryan plan? AARP says it would undermine Medicare and could lead to higher costs for seniors.
You paid into Medicare for years. Every paycheck. Now when you need it, Obama has cut $716 billion from Medicare. Why? To pay for Obamacare. So now the money you paid for your guaranteed health care is going to a massive new government program that's not for you.
Robert Higgs, both of these ads are about Medicare, but they take different tacks. Would one attract you or attract PolitiFact more than another in terms of vetting it?
They probably both would. And I'm not as familiar with the first one, but the second one, I know there are specific parts of it that PolitiFact has actually vetted to explain that $716 billion figure. But they both are good examples of what gets our attention. When we see something like this go, you're as a viewer seeing a 15 or a 30 second spot and stuff's flying by fast and it's going to be boiled down to soundbite size. For the listener, they're not going to get a lot of detail attached to that, so they can't vet it on the spot. And a lot of people don't have the ability or the time or a sense of where to go to find out the answers for some of this stuff. So that's when we hear something like that, and the general rule of thumb is if it makes us say, really, then we're going to go take a look at it. And,
well, the Obama ad, in contrast to the Romney ad, the first ad, in other words, had cited sources for each assertion. Throughout. And once again, you're right. This stuff's flying by pretty fast. So you see some kind of site there and you're thinking, well, all right, it must be true then, right?
Well, that is actually something we have seen a lot of. There are politicians, some of the people we deal with in Ohio, who are very, very careful about having their sites attached. And some of them that I know, when I get something in the mail, I can trust the sites just because of their track record. But sometimes the sites will be to legitimate news stories or legitimate sources, but the phrasing in the claim itself will not be what the site says, or it'll be turned a little bit on end or something like that. So even though the sites are there, it might not be quite on point. And that's what makes some of these so hard to sort out is if they cite a Washington Post story, people see Washington Post and they think, oh, that's a trusted news source. There must be something to it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly what the Washington Post story said. And I think that makes it all the more challenging for the average listener who hears these statements go by. Is the sites lend a sense of credibility, but it all depends on whether they're being cited correctly, too.
Right. James in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling in. I just want to say the Republican primaries were a bloodbath. And, you know, I remember when Newt Gingrich was saying, you know, Mitt Romney, the super PACs, and he got on TV and, you know, Mitt Romney says, hey, you know, this was politics and this, you know, nobody said it was easy. And then we 3 months later, Mitt Romney's crying about the ads. You know, he's kind of turned into Newt Gingrich. What happened to this is politics and this is kind of the way it is? You know, I mean, I don't understand it. He's got 1,000 gaffes.
Okay.
How about this? I'll bet you $10,000 they've got 1,000 gaffes on this guy.
Okay. Robert Higgs, any thoughts about that?
Well, I think he has raised something that there are a lot of people who are concerned about, and that is a lot of the attack ads, and what we have seen generally is the more outlandish claims are coming in these attack ads from political action committees,
mm-hmm.
the so-called super PACs, and there's concern over transparency on who's putting up the money and where they're coming from, but there's not the same kind of checks on them as there are on the candidates themselves. And we've seen a lot of that in Ohio with the Mandel Brown race. We've seen ads for both of the candidates, sympathetic to Josh Mandel and sympathetic to Sherrod Brown, attacking the other candidates that are from those PACs. And you see more outlandish claims in those sometimes. And I think there's a certain distaste out there, but still that material is all being pushed out into the viewers' faces they're watching, say, a newscast in the evening.
James, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. If anyone else wants to give us a call, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm speaking with Robert Higgs. He's an editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He's also an editor of PolitiFact Ohio. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Robert Higgs, I suppose it depends on the race, but what are the big topics out there? Is it just Medicare? Is it the federal budget? Are they all the usual things?
I think this election cycle, at least with the congressional races and the presidency and the Senate race, what you're going to see an endless parade of are ads that touch on the federal budget and spending and really on health care, the repeal of Obamacare, and on Medicare. And then the two ads that you played a few moments ago are good examples. You're going to hear that $716 billion figure quite a bit for a while. And you're going to hear a government takeover of health care repeated over and over again. And then you're going to hear from the other side, you're going to hear trying to kill Medicare as we know it, mm-hmm. with their plans. And those are hot-button issues to a lot of voters. And the candidates know that, and they're going to stay on those themes and as part of the reason you should support them. And I would not at all be surprised if they were the dominant issues. PolitiFact has done what they call a lie of the year. It's the only time PolitiFact uses the word lie, actually. As one time each year, they pick out the claim that was repeated the most and most outlandish that it dominated the headlines. And each year that PolitiFact National has done this to date, it's been a healthcare claim. And I would not at all be surprised if we get to the end of this year and it's a healthcare claim again.
We have to wait until the end of the year to know, though.
Yeah, it comes right after Christmas.
I mean, after all the work you've done on this so far, and of course you've been probably following these sorts of things for years before you got involved with PolitiFact, but does anything still shock you?
Not. Yeah, actually there is. The thing that I see a lot, and I just kind of shake my head at sometimes, and I see it from all ends of the political spectrum. There is this desire to have the gotcha line sometimes that I think is too enticing to whoever's writing up the script for some of these ads. And we see the claims coming from the various campaigns, and healthcare is a good example. There are legitimate debates on both sides of the Obamacare issue about whether it's the right way to go or whether it's bad policy. And sometimes, though, in the desire to make it a real gotcha statement, the speaker goes a little too far. And it would be so easy to have something that's really bulletproof, and then you're dealing with debate of an issue. But that desire to have the gotcha statement, I think it's part of us becoming much, for the greater part, a soundbite society in some ways, that you want that quick, crisp line, almost like a great advertisement.
Let's hear from Andrew in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Andrew. You're on the air with Robert Higgs, editor of PolitiFact Ohio.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine,
pretty
thanks.
Good.
My question is, well, I've actually decided to change it from my previous question to a new question, but is there any way that both these candidates could come together and agree on something where they aren't mud-rucking together? Because I'm not sure if this is hyperbolic, but somebody told me that right now this country is divided more than the Civil War, and I'm not sure if that is really valid, but is there any way that these candidates could come together so we aren't divided anymore and we could actually come with some sort of chiasm where we could actually get this country back together again?
Robert Higgs?
Well, I think he's correct in that we are more polarized now than in many, many years. We've grown more and more polarized. But bringing it back together is not easily done. We talked to some political scientists for a piece we did a few weeks ago when PolitiFact Ohio marked its second anniversary. And one of the people we talked to was a professor at the University of Miami down in Oxford. And he said part of the problem here is that there is no punishment for a lot of the misstatement. A candidate can let stuff fly and attack his opponent, and it doesn't necessarily have to be accurate for them to get a message out. And even if it's wrong, for the most part, there's no coming back and penalizing it. Now, that said, we have seen some cases where politicians have changed their statements over time and adjusted them, where we suspect it's in part because of PolitiFact or some of the other fact-checking organizations that are out there. So over the long haul, maybe that'll get us back towards a sense of civil discourse, but it's a long haul, certainly.
Andrew, thanks for the call.
Yeah,
go ahead, Andrew.
The way I see it, it's like making it's like you're putting slander in somebody else's name and their actions. And I don't. Again, I saw absolutely no punishment in that, and it's just appalling to me that people will have laws on. Yeah, you can't say something bad about, let's say, Pepsi. But when it comes down to actual politics, you can go crazy with that.
Well, it is very. It seems like very much the paper tiger when it comes to state, you know, oversight of campaign advertising. Robert Higgs.
Mm-hmm.
And federal.
It is, because we put a premium on ability to speak freely and exchange ideas. Mm-hmm. And where if you start curtailing that with some kind of accuracy checking, how far back does that roll back? I mean, in many cases, a lot of the claims you're hearing that are their attacks are nuanced, and they are differences of opinion and policies that are turned into attacks. They're not necessarily factually wrong. And so if you start trying to attach some punishment to it, I think the fear you'd find out there is, all right, where do we stop? And as a society, if we're not willing to go there, and I'm certainly not advocating that necessarily, but I think that's why you're going to see it continue to be somewhat of a paper tiger.
Thanks a lot, Andrew, for that call. You mentioned that sometimes they'll amend the ads after they've been vetted a little bit. Has the trend to vet the ads, do you think it makes any difference in the content overall? Do you think that's where a lot of the citations are coming from and that sort of thing?
Well, I think that we know from dealing with politicians that there are many out there who take this very seriously. where they have instructed their staffs, double check everything before you put out a news release. I do not want it to be wrong. I do not want to get caught in this, because they value their own accuracy and their own, and the ability to be trusted. And where we've seen that show up then is sometimes in stump speeches and things like that. We've seen on the Democratic side, we've seen them amend the statement that the Paul Ryan budget would kill Medicare, to say it'll kill it as we know it, because PolitiFact came out on that very early saying, no, if you look at the Ryan budget, there will be a Medicare program. It will be vastly different from what's there now, but it's not like it's eliminated and gone forever. And in that sense, we know that there's been some changing of the phrases that they're using. That said, that doesn't hurt their argument, because their whole point is you won't like what's coming, and they can still make that point. So I think there are some cases where it is making a difference like that.
From Jason on Facebook, he writes, these ads are a part of politics. People who want better information will look for it. Negative ads are, however, good fodder for talk radio. Yes, they are, Jason. Thanks a lot. Speaking of, though, the idea of people who want better information will look for it, how do people, what's your advice to, you know, people who are not necessarily going to go online and go to PolitiFact and figure it all out when they're just watching this stuff passively? Any recommendations for things they should look for to maybe raise a red flag?
Yeah, there are a couple things that anybody can do. And the starting point is you have to keep in mind that in many respects we've become a soundbite society. And you're going to see these soundbites at work in ads or in speeches, news conferences, things like that. And one of the things that I think you can rely on is if you keep hearing the same soundbite more and more and more, you should question it. That probably means it was crafted for a very specific purpose, and it may not be completely on point. Also, if you're watching a TV ads, and you see something come by that just sounds really outrageous, like clearly meant to get your blood boiling as you're watching the ad, pause for a second to think, now, could that really be as simple as that? Because a lot of the statements are very oversimplified, and in some cases just very selectively chosen words make a big difference. So look at them with a skeptical eye, and then if you're still not sure, check when they come by and see if you can see what their sources are and go look at the source.
From Donnie on Facebook, he says, many people are decidedly left or right going into Election Day. The negative campaign ads is an easy way to sway last-minute voters in the middle who aren't able to keep up and ignorant of the facts. And those voters, these voters make a difference. To the point of last minute, the negative campaigns, negative ads seem to be right at the, you know, coming right out of the gate now.
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be that last minute. I can't imagine what kind of flurry there's going to be at the last minute that can be more negative than we've already experienced.
I think they have become more prevalent. I think it's because the data suggests that they do make a difference. The presidential race is an example. The advertising that the Obama campaign and some of the surrogates, the political action committees out there that are supporting the president, that they launched that attacked Mitt Romney for his time at Bain Capital, certainly made a difference in the impressions of Mitt Romney to the public. So I think there is an attraction there to use them, and you'll hear candidates say, "Oh, I don't want to go negative," but it's hard to argue that they don't have an impact.
From Steve on Facebook, he says, I'm sick of the negativity on all fronts, not just ads. Stump speeches, which seem like they used to contain a little actual content about the candidate who is speaking, now sound like extended attacks on opponents. I long for something rational and substantive, like I imagine campaigns of old were like. Am I just imagining this, or have campaigns become more superficial in the last couple decades? Which is an interesting distinction to use the word superficial, I think.
Well,
versus negative. Or is superficiality a function of negative?
I don't know that it's necessarily a function of it, but I think it certainly is there. The piece I mentioned a little bit ago about where we talked to some political scientists out there, one of them was saying it used to be that a good soundbite was a 30-second soundbite. And then he said, now 30 seconds would be like a filibuster. That we have gotten to where the time is so compressed on those that the statements get shorter and shorter and shorter, and they've got to hit a point really fast. And the more detail you lose, I think the more you run the risk of it being very superficial and lacking substance. And that makes it harder then for the person who's really trying to sort through the issues to tell just from what they're hearing in those ads.
In the book In Defense of Negativity, political scientist John Gear said that negative ads are more likely to be accurate than positive ads because there's more rigorous fact-checking for negative ads. What do you think about that?
I think they're more likely to get caught.
Okay.
Because the negative ads get people's attention, and that naturally then is going to drive more query. We see other fact checkers at work too. The Washington Post does some, the AP does some, and there's several other organizations out there besides PolitiFact. And at this time of year, you're seeing them look at a lot more of the negative claims because the claims are meant to attack and weaken the opponent. And people look at those and they wonder, it's that old, really, is that true? So I think that they are going to get more attention, but I wouldn't necessarily say that they are more often wrong than the positive statements, because sometimes we see people padding their resumes in those ads too. We did a Mandel ad where we checked five separate statements through it, and we found positive statements and negative statements both in it, and the accuracy of them was all over the place, but it wasn't necessarily that just all of the negative statements were bad, were inaccurate, and all the positive ones were good.
Okay. All right. Well, Robert Higgs, thanks for joining us today. I hope you can come back again as the election season continues to wind in whatever direction.
Well, it's my pleasure. Going.
All right. Thanks. Robert Higgs, he's editor of PolitiFact Ohio. Coming up, we're going to talk about the psychological impact of the negative campaigns. Are we just all used to it and can take it? Or are we still wired for something kinder and gentler? We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Furor and Backtrack, after Missouri GOP Senate candidate Todd Akin talks of legitimate rape and the roots of that remark. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And what can we learn about the political landscape from the ever-expanding world of social media? We'll hear from someone who really counts those tweets and posts. And then, how to get the most from Netflix and more on the latest gadgets. It's Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 here on 89.7 NPR News. 68 degrees with cloudy skies. Expect rain for today. Later this afternoon, a high of 81. Mostly cloudy for tonight, a low of 54 degrees. Sunshine on Wednesday and a high of 82, clear skies Wednesday night, a low of 57 degrees, and more sunshine on Thursday with a high of 84. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Not every negative political ad is scary or threatening. Take this example from the GOP primary. It's from a super PAC opposed to Newt Gingrich.
Ever notice how some people make a lot of mistakes?
It's probably a mistake. I made a mistake. I've made mistakes at times.
So far, Newt Gingrich has admitted his mistakes or flipped on, teaming up with Nancy Pelosi, immigration, Medicare, healthcare, Iraq, attacking Mitt Romney, and more.
I made a big mistake in the spring.
Haven't we had enough mistakes? Restore Our Future is responsible for the content of this message.
Okay, on its face, that negative ad seems harmless. It uses mostly bright colors if you watch it on YouTube, and the voiceover is lighthearted, joking almost. Do ads like that compare to the dark style in terms of their impact and how we feel about politics? Joining us now to talk about that and how negative politics affect us and our society is Sean Mesherer. He's author of The Bliss Experiment. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Let's just take that ad for example. You know, we've been listening to ads all hour, and most of them are very dark, very scary, with the really discordant undertones and threatening voiceovers, that sort of thing. This wasn't like that. This wasn't so bad, right?
Well, on the scale of things, honestly, it's not that bad. It's more that no one ad ever comes in isolation by itself. There's always an accumulation of them over time. And it's more that in aggregate, a lot of these kinds of negative ads, and even fairly mild ones, can start to have very serious negative consequences for us and our democracy.
That ad had sort of a tone of a schoolyard taunt, kind of that sort of passive-aggressive bullying kind of thing.
It does. And what happens over time, even with, you know, these kinds of lighter things, is first, and kind of should be obvious, but is surprisingly not always obvious to people, is that they make us very cynical about politicians and the political process and our own democracy. And that has a tendency, as time goes on, even when it's, you know, quote unquote, our side, the side that we're rooting for putting out the ad, we start to become cynical about everyone. It becomes a pox on both their houses kind of vibe. You know, we might get a little short-term glee, but really we're completely undercutting our belief in democracy. And, you know, this is one reason that voter turnouts are slowly trending downwards. We're getting very, very cynical about our process, and that's not good for the country.
That is something we haven't talked about. The actual purpose of some of these ads is not to inform one way or the other per se, but it's to turn off the voters.
It
literally
is. Yeah, it is very much to do that. In fact, I mean, we all know this, and I'm not going to really get into partisan politics, but let's just say that there are certain groups of people who are very clearly interested in actually suppressing voter turnout in one way or another. And making us cynical is one very effective way of doing that.
My guest, if you're just joining us, Sean Mesherer, he's written the book The Bliss Experiment. We're talking about the larger impact of negative advertising on us individually and as a society. You've written some emails to us. If you have anything else to add about this topic, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Steve on Facebook, I read this comment a little bit earlier, Sean, but I wanted to go back to the first paragraph. He said, "I'm sick of the negativity on all fronts, not just ads. Stump speeches, which seem like they used to contain a little actual content about the candidate who is speaking now, sound like extended attacks on opponents. It's not just the ads. There is something to that, right?"
Oh, absolutely. And Steve is totally right. That's what's happening in our landscape. And one of the key things, and one of the reasons that he's right to be sick about it and interested in maybe looking for solutions, is that these kinds of things don't just make us cynical about our democracy or other people, but the flip side of it is what happens inside each of ourselves, our own minds as individuals. There's some really compelling research that now shows the kinds of impact that immersing ourselves in this negativity can have. For example, the more we surround ourselves with this or bombarded with it, we as individuals can become susceptible to depression, anxiety, anger, and all kinds of other very, very serious negative emotions. And it's a real problem for some people.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sean, I wanted to talk a little bit about whether you, what if you agree with the ad? Does that necessarily make you feel better? Or was that what you were getting at when you're saying, even if it's the party that we're backing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, we have parties or particular politicians or issues that one politician represents better than another that we care about and we want to win. And so we all have that little tendency to say, well, as long as it's our side who's scoring the point or however they win is better than losing, you know, and a little bit of schadenfreude about, you know, someone we don't like getting taken down. We all have that little kind of urge or liking of it in the short term. But in the long term, it's just going to backfire on us. First of all, because all it's going to do is promote a barrage of retaliation against our candidate, our position, our whatever, that will often be as negative or it'll up the ante. But even still, it undermines our belief, even in our own position and the candidates that we support. When we see them going relentlessly negative, we know at a certain level that they're not being sort of the highest ideal of what we would want in a politician. We know that they're not inspiring us so much as they're winning through, you know, wrecking everything. And that has a very, very serious long-term consequence, I think, on our democracy. And we're not really paying attention to that.
Austin in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Austin.
Howdy.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like to thank you both. It's an honor, honestly. I agree completely with the speaker, too. My point was basically how much even campaigning has changed in the past 10 years, 12 years for me, because that's the most recent time that I've been paying attention. I'm 21 right now. I can tell you that just kids are no longer asking the question, kids as well as adults, and we've become so stratified and polarized, and it's now me and you, and there's no possibility of us relating to each other if you're a Democrat or Republican. Unfortunately, that's the mentality that most people hold, and I think that it's tearing people apart, and it's making people very discontent with our political system as a whole. We just are tired of it. We don't understand the laws, and I think we just are all ready for a change. But
I think, you know, Austin, you're making an interesting point as far as the age group goes, because, Sean, I mean, this stuff is not just on, you know, the weekly news panel discussions on Sundays. This is everywhere. It's everywhere on the Internet, everywhere on Facebook, everywhere on Twitter.
Yes, absolutely. You know, Austin, you're just exactly right. And the word that keeps coming up, some of your earlier guests mentioned it and earlier participants, is polarized, polarized. We're becoming very, very polarized. But here's the thing, and what's interesting about it from this sort of psychological point of view, in the world of cognitive behavioral psychology, the concept of being a polarized thinker is considered a very negative, bad thing, mentally speaking. Mm. In fact, polarization is considered one of the signs of of there being cognitive errors in our consciousness. So when we talk about polarization, which you're very accurately doing, that really is a de facto stand-in way of saying something has gotten badly, incorrectly, and inaccurately distorted in our perspective. It's not something to celebrate. That's basically a sign of mental disease. And that's something that we really need to correct. And, you know, Austin, the other thing you said that was really true and perceptive, given that you're only 21, is because there was like a very well-known representative before your time, Pat Schroeder from Colorado. And she talked about when she retired how one of the reasons that she needed to get out of Congress was that when she started, congresspeople from different parties could have a very, you know, deep and hard-fought debate on the floor about a particular issue. They could even sling some arrows, but afterwards they could all go out for a beer together, the Democrats, the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And she said by the time she retired, that was no longer possible. If you, you know, disagreed with someone on the floor of Congress, you could not go out and be friends with them, be kind with them, have a beer with them, and that sense of underlying respect is just completely gone now in our system.
Definitely.
Well, Austin.
If I can add something.
Sure.
I feel as though, I mean, and this is just me, again, 21, but I pay attention to things. And the political atmosphere of today is one, people just don't care. It's disinterest. And that is now applying to every major field in our life. We've become surrounded by this culture of superficiality, where honesty is no longer of any value. No integrity, no self-honor or self-respect and self-discipline doesn't mean anything, as long as you can charm people out of something that you may want. And that's the thing too, is this separating of the youth and of our whole society. It's ending up in us looking for material goods to replace those relationships that really are the only things that are of value in our lives. And it's sickening to me at 21, and I don't want to turn 50 years old and live in the same world. And so that's what gets me. I see many people just tuning out and not paying attention. But what we need is someone to put everything in context instead of try to build walls around who they are and what they've done. True leaders are going to have bank accounts.
Austin, I'm sorry, we have to end it there because we're out of time, but I thank you for your call and thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Sean Mesher, we have to end it there, but I've enjoyed the conversation and I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sean Mesher, he is the author of The Bliss Experiment. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.